Maddie is brought to you by 9.com.au. To enjoy some of our other great shows, such as NRL podcast Six Tackles with Gus, or our deep dive into the royal family, the Windsors, head to 9.com.au/podcasts or search for us wherever you listen.
In the following podcast from 9.com.au, we are not suggesting Kate and Jerry McCann were responsible for what happened to Maddie or are lying. Her case is simply a mystery, but they were considered suspects by the Portuguese police, and we examine why that was and why the questions about what happened to Maddie haven't gone away.
We're just hearing that a search is underway for a three-year-old British girl who's gone missing in the Algarve area of Portugal.
Someone's taken her. Madeline's gone.
Words cannot describe the anguish and despair that we are feeling as the parents of our beautiful daughter, Madeline.
Parents of Madeline McCann are now considered formal suspects by the Portuguese police authorities.
We have played no part in the disappearance of our lovely daughter, Madeline.
There are days when you just want to get under the duvet or just want to be in a coma till it's over, just to relieve the pain and get some peace, but you can't.
Before we start this week's episode, a bit of an update. Over Easter weekend, an army of UK tabloids all began to report on revelations which were first aired in Maddie. You'll remember how Dr. Perlin had made an offer to Scotland Yard to potentially solve 18 vital DNA samples linked to Maddie's disappearance. And you'll also remember how that offer appeared to have been stonewalled by Scotland Yard. My ongoing attempts to get comment from Scotland Yard, the UK Home Office and the UK Prime Minister's Office have all been refused. This week a story appeared in the UK's biggest tabloid, The Sun. The headline screamed, "Maddie DNA blow. Hope new DNA tech could help crack Madeline McCann's disappearance are dashed after it fails to produce a match." The story went on to talk about an advanced wonder technique called DNA 17. According to The Sun, an unnamed source said DNA 17 was used to check samples from the apartment where Maddie vanished but had found nothing. Curious about this DNA 17, I got on the phone to Dr. Mark Perlin, and I asked him about DNA 17, which the article had hailed as one of the biggest DNA breakthroughs in 20 years. Well, it turns out that DNA 17, that advanced wonder technique, has actually been around in the US for 15 years.
This is my point. This is old. Basically, this DNA 17 is an older technology that's being used now and being claimed as being new. There's nothing terribly new about it. It's new for the British, which only recently moved to these larger kits.
Dr. Perlin explained how DNA 17 was certainly better, more powerful than FSS methods used in 2007. He said DNA 17 could produce more data, but that is only one part of the forensic puzzle. DNA 17 still cannot interpret complex data, as had been made clear by the unnamed source in The Sun. To interpret data, you need a computational testing method, like Dr. Perlin's True Allele or the New Zealand lab StarMix. The source in the article did not state when DNA 17 had been used to reanalyze those 2007 McCann samples.
In the article that you sent me, the revolutionary tests from 10 or 20 years ago are being described as being used, but the issue of interpreting the data is not mentioned. And interpreting the mixtures is the more important part of the problem. This move may be revolutionary for Britain or for Portugal, but it's not revolutionary technology. It's been around for a decade or two. I don't give you any spin, I don't think. I just try to explain what it says.
Before I got off the phone, I asked Mark again if Scotland Yard and DCI Nicola Wall had responded to his offer.
I'll check my email again this instant. I doubt they'll be emailing me in the middle of the night. No. But to speak sarcastically a little bit, why would they need to contact anyone else? They have their answer of inconclusive from DNA 17.
Okay, with DNA 17 put to bed, let's get on with this week's episode. When I set out to make Maddie, I held on to a small glimmer of hope that before the final episode, I might get to speak with a man who has intimate knowledge of the Madeline McCann case. Some might say this man got so close to the case, it burned him. Late on Thursday night, that flicker of hope I'd held on to, well, it turned into something very real. Hello, Gonzalo.
Si.
Gonzalo Amaral. It's good to speak with you.
Si.
My name is Mark Salnokonoko, and I'm a reporter for 9.com.au, and this is a podcast called Maddie. The Maddie podcast series explores what many believe is the well-known story of Madeleine McCann's disappearance. But this is an investigation of the evidence that could make you question everything you thought you knew about the case.
With the help of a translator, Gonzalo Amaral and I spoke for an hour. We'd been set to speak the night before, but the interview had fallen over at the last moment. I was anxious it might happen again, or that maybe Gonzalo would reconsider and cancel altogether. But then there he was on the other end of the line.
I will begin now if you're ready, Gonzalo.
Okay.
Okay.
My hour with Gonzalo raced by, and we covered a lot of things. He spoke about Operation Grange and perceived interference from UK police in his team's investigation. Gonzalo Amaral told me about police statements, which he believed had been buried by authorities. He also detailed some aspects of his 5 months leading the case before he was removed 1 month after Kate and Jerry McCann were declared arguidos. We spoke about Dr. Perlin and the DNA data we've been chasing as well. Some of Gonzalo's interview will appear in this episode of Maddie, with more to come later. Remember, Gonzalo Amaral was the top guy assigned to lead the investigation at the beginning, from the moment Maddie vanished. I'm not overstating things when I say Amaral has little love for the English-speaking media, and he rarely gives interviews. But for now, I just want to underline the potential importance of the DNA and the forensic evidence pulled from the McCann's rental car, the silver Renault Scenic. Here's BBC Panorama in November 2007 on that car. Reporter Richard Bilton is speaking with a man named John Corner. John Corner was a family friend of the McCann's, and he was doing some filming for a McCann-sanctioned documentary of events in 2007. In the Panorama clip, Richard Bilton is talking about how it had been reported, for example, that the body was shifted in the back of this vehicle, a Renault Scenic, that the McCanns had hired 25 days after Madeleine disappeared. Bilton spoke about how some press had reported that the McCanns drove the car to Huelva in Spain on the 3rd of August, where they had allegedly disposed of the body. According to the McCanns, footage shot by John Corner shows the only trip they made to Huelva.
Truly bizarre. I mean, we use it as a base for the crew.
So that effectively is evidence, isn't it? Because that is this trip to Spain, when if reports are to be believed, in the back of that vehicle is the body of Madeleine McCann.
In the back of that vehicle was a lot of posters of Madeleine and me and my cameraman. It's quite sickening, really, the speculation around what was a genuine trip out to Spain to try and raise public awareness about Madeleine. This is a couple who are desperately looking for their missing daughter. The thought of them having Madeleine in the car is just obscene.
Richard Bilton went on to say that a source had told him police were interested in the car. Bilton said that source had told him it was a mystery why the vehicle had done so many miles, while Kate and Jerry had left it behind while they were on trips across Europe. The hatchback Renault Scenic was hired by the McCanns for 4 months. When the keys were given to the McCanns on May 27, 2007, the vehicle had 3,100 kilometres on the odometer. On 23 September, when the car was returned, it had 14,400 kilometres on the clock. In 4 months, it travelled more than 11,000 kilometres. So I suppose that's what BBC reporter Richard Bilton was talking about in that report, when he claimed a police source said the mileage the car had racked up was of interest. As you'll remember, the car became the subject of intense police interest after Eddie and Keeler, a cadaver and human blood dog team, made alerts in and around the vehicle, including the boot compartment. A man named Martin Grime was Eddie and Keeler's dog handler. Here's some audio of Martin speaking in an underground car park, where the Renault Scenic and 9 other cars had been parked up by police officers. Martin's dogs, Eddie and Keeler, had just completed a search of all 10 vehicles.
We've screened the vehicles using the dog, and the only reaction we've had is to the car in the far corner. I'll tell you which one it is. And what we have is a reaction from the dog over here, where his head's up in the air, and he's scenting the items that he's trying to find. And when we tie him down, he picks this car from this door. The important thing to realise is that he's picking the scent that's coming out through the seal of the door.
As we know by now, the work of the dogs has to be backed up with corroborating evidence. And as we know, DNA samples were taken, but ruled inconclusive. I've tried several times to interview Martin Grime. He's always declined, but we've corresponded over email. In one of our messages, what Martin wrote showed he's worn out by debate, some of it ill-informed, over the work that was carried out by Eddie and Keeler. Here's some of what he wrote. The Madeleine McCann case has been going on for 12 years. The dog responses have been discussed over and over and over. It's pretty common for people and the media to say the dogs were wrong because the DNA came back inconclusive. But as Martin explained, that line of thinking showed the dogs' work and their alerts had been misunderstood. The dogs are trained to search for and locate odour. Their responses merely show us where to look for evidence. People are missing the point. The dog responses were confirmed by the recovery of DNA samples. Just because the analysis of those samples did not provide conclusive results, you can't just trash what the dogs do. What the alerts of cadaver and human blood dogs say to police is, look here, this spot is worth investigating. The police did look where the dogs alerted. DNA was found behind the sofa in apartment 5A, and DNA was found in the boot of the rental car. The dogs had been correct. It was the testing methods of the FSS in 2007 which had failed to conclusively decipher that DNA. When considering the car and the unproven theory that Madeleine's body had possibly been in the boot of the car, people will naturally arrive at a pretty vexing juncture, and it's this. How would it be possible, with all the media and all the police attention, for Madeleine's body to be hidden somewhere, put in the Renault Scenic, and whisked away to a secret location? It's a really excellent question. How possible would that have been? I asked a Portuguese journalist, Duarte Levy, about this. I wanted to know if reporters and cops had been staked out outside the McCann's villa 24/7. 5, 6, 7 weeks after Maddie vanished, were reporters still crawling all over the McCann's? Duarte's reply was cryptic.
The point is that we are not speaking only about Jerry or Kate.
Duarte pointed out that multiple people had access to that car and were driving it during that period. I put the same question to Gonzalo Amaral. He had an answer for me too, which had similarities to what Duarte had told me. Gonzalo also pointed out that the McCanns had made a number of trips to Morocco and throughout Europe, including Rome, Berlin, and Amsterdam. And when the McCanns left town, leaving their car behind, the eager press pack followed them into Europe.
He also says that it is not impossible at all, people say what the couple was constantly being watched by journalists. It's not true. He says clearly that is not true. There were periods when there were no journalists present. During the night, there were no journalists in Praia da Luz, and they were not being watched by journalists 24/7 at all. Even more so when the couple was away to visit the Vatican or to go other places, that there were absolutely no journalists present because the journalists followed the couple on those trips and there were other people that stayed behind.
In a controversial documentary, which was based on his book, The Truth of the Lie, Gonzalo Amaral spoke to a woman who claimed to have witnessed an unusual occurrence involving the McCann's rental car. The woman lived close to the Praia da Luz villa that the McCann's had moved into in early July 2007, after they had left apartment 5A at the Ocean Club Resort. In the documentary, the woman's face is not shown, but she makes an allegation about the McCann's car, which was parked in the driveway. What the woman was claiming was this, that for a period of days, she noticed the boot of the Renault Scenic was left open, day and night. I was keen to hear more about this woman from Gonzalo Amaral. He told me the woman, a lawyer, had contacted the Policía Judiciaria. Remember, a translator is on the line with Gonzalo and I.
This neighbor, she is, like you said, a lawyer. The police thought she was a very credible witness. The fact is that nobody denied that there was a situation with a smell in the car. Nobody denied it, and it was justified with allegedly trash bags being transported in the car. Gonzalo presumes that these trash bags would have been, you know, have had holes, and that the actual trash bins had to be very far away for the trash to be transported in the car. For the police, it was an indication that they were trying to disguise the smell of a dead body, of a cadaver.
What I'd noticed after watching the documentary and hearing this woman making allegations about the open car boot was that her statement did not seem to be inside the official police files. I asked Gonzalo about that. Why was that?
Gonzalo says that her statement should be in the files. He does not recall whether it was an informal statement or a formal statement was taken. But he knows that it did take place, that she was interviewed by the police. Whether it was formally or not, he's not sure anymore, but it should be in the case files. Even more so because family members of the McCanns then told the newspapers about this trash transportation issue. And there is absolutely no doubt that this took place, this happened, even more so because it was actually reinforced by the statements that the family members gave to the media.
Two relatives of the McCanns both made police statements where they talked about a strange smell in the back of the McCanns' hire car. Those two men were Alexander Cameron, at the time married to Jerry's sister, Patricia, and Michael Wright, a man married to Kate's cousin. Both men spent time in Praia da Luz as family members arrived to support Kate and Jerry. On their arrival, both men were added as drivers to the rental car agreement for that Renault Scenic hatchback. In April 2008, Portuguese police requested English police take statements from both those men about the Renault Scenic. Both men said Kate and Jerry had nothing to do with Maddie's disappearance. They said it was impossible Kate and Jerry could have used the car to transport Maddie's dead body. But both men acknowledged there was an unusual odour in the back of the car. In their statements, the smell was described as strange and disagreeable. Michael Wright claimed the strong smell could have come from Sean and Emily's nappies, which he said had been in rubbish bags carried in the boot of the car. Alexander Cameron put the unpleasant odour down to blood, which had leaked from beef, fish and shrimp he had bought from a store and placed in the boot of the car. Alexander Cameron said the smell was so bad that he had removed the carpet from the boot of the car, washed it and put it back inside. On the day of May 3, 2007, Madeline was there. After nightfall, but before midnight, she was suddenly gone. 14 months after Maddie vanished, the Portuguese police shelved the case. That hit the end of the road. After 14 months of painstaking work, there was evidence, but the evidence could not conclusively prove how or what had happened to Madeline. In 2011, 3 years after Portuguese police had shelved the case, London's Metropolitan Police launched Operation Grange, a special investigation to review Madeline's disappearance. Former London Met homicide detective Colin Sutton, who is now retired, had been tipped as a possible candidate to lead Operation Grange. Remember, Colin Sutton solved 30-plus murders working for the Met, including catching serial killer Levi Belfield and Britain's worst serial rapist, the Night Stalker. But Colin never took the Operation Grange job. He told me about a strange phone call he got one night, warning him about what appeared to be high-level political instruction, certainly from within Scotland Yard, possibly a directive from government, over how the investigation would and should be managed.
I was privately told by a senior officer that it was going to be an investigation where you were told what things you could and couldn't look at. The remit and the focus of Operation Grange has been so narrow that it probably was hobbled from the beginning and didn't really have a chance of succeeding.
The officially stated remit of Operation Grange was to investigate an abduction. But what if there never was an abduction? What about other lines of inquiry? Operation Grange detectives have apparently never questioned Kate and Jerry McCann. They have also reportedly never questioned any members of the Tapas 7. The official line from Scotland Yard in Operation Grange is that the Portuguese police have already investigated and cleared Kate and Jerry McCann of any involvement. Now retired, the Met Police Assistant Commissioner Mark Rowley spoke to media in 2017 on the 10th anniversary of Madeline's disappearance. He was asked about Operation Grange's remit of an abduction and if the McCanns had ever been interviewed under caution.
2 points to that. Firstly, the parents' involvement. That was dealt with at the time. That was dealt with at the time by the original investigation by the Portuguese. So all the material, we're happy that's completely dealt with, and there's no reason whatsoever to reopen that or to start rumours that that's a line of investigation. The McCanns are parents of a missing girl who we're trying to get to the bottom of what happened. In terms of Andy using the word abduction, she wasn't old enough to make a decision to set off and start her own life. However she left that apartment, she's been abducted. It's not a 20-year-old who's gone missing who maybe there's foul play or maybe they've decided to start a new life. This is a young girl who's missing, and so there has to at the heart of this at least be an abduction.
Here's Colin Sutton again questioning Mark Rowley's assertion the PJ had cleared the McCanns. Bear in mind, as detailed in the 2017 Supreme Court ruling and the libel case against Gonzalo Amaral, the McCanns' arguido status was lifted when the investigation was shelved, but it hadn't formally excluded them.
My understanding is that the Portuguese police, the PJ, their view very much is that they haven't eliminated Kate and Jerry McCann, that they're not eliminated, they're no longer arguidos, and you know, it's no longer an active investigation, but they say that they were never eliminated.
Colin's thinking seems at odds with the senior UK police officer, a man called Simon Foy, who ended up getting the job Colin says he was warned off in that mysterious phone call. Here's Simon Foy, former head of homicide with the London Met, speaking to the BBC Panorama programme in 2017 about the McCanns and Operation Grange.
Even on the first glance of what we looked at, and when we took the information back and ran it through our own understanding and, you know, verified sightings and accounts and statements and all the rest of it, it was perfectly clear to us that the McCanns themselves had nothing at all to do with the actual disappearance.
Why?
Because it was just obvious from, you know, that everything stacked up, that they were where they were when the child went missing.
Foy's position seems too simplistic for Colin Sutton.
I've not seen, and I don't think there is in the kind of public domain, any conclusive evidence that elimination has taken place. And if it's possible to do it, then I think it should be done because, as I say, I think that would be in everybody's interests.
Graham Whetton, who served more than 3 decades with Scotland Yard, told me he's also confused by the remit of Operation Grange because it seems to fly in the face of Detective Work 101.
Grange's remit, looking at what the initial investigation team said when they first took this on, the senior investigation officer appeared to make it clear that Grange was looking at a criminal act by a stranger, which was quite definitive because it was almost like we are not going to look at every potential answer to this. this was, it had, in some respects, from an investigator's perspective, a quite a narrow remit. When you review an investigation, you would normally go in with a completely open mind, clear slate, have a look at this completely from afresh.
Operation Grange remains live and open, reportedly chasing a significant final line of inquiry. Graham Whitten told me he finds that phrasing interesting.
Personally, I think there must be some there seems to be that there's some external pressure on Scotland Yard, on the Metropolitan Police, to keep this going for another period of time. Because, as I said, you would normally have something a bit more than just a significant line of inquiry. A significant line of inquiry is such a cover-all phrase. It doesn't actually tell you what they are looking at, or where that line of inquiry is going. Without telling you what it is exactly, it doesn't give you the significant line of inquiry revolves around exactly what happened to her, or where she is now, or who is involved. That extra bit hasn't been put out. And from the investigation team, they could say something like that without completely explaining what it is they're looking at.
Pat Brown, a US criminal profiler, delivers an even harsher, more direct verdict on Operation Grange. Unlike Colin Sutton and Graham Whitten, Pat Brown has no loyalty to the force or old friends and colleagues, perhaps still working there.
Unfortunately, and people don't like to hear this, I think this case is dead in the water. I mean, I thought this case was dead in the water from the moment Scotland Yard came in and said that their remit was for abduction. The Scotland Yard investigation, which has gone on for 7 years and has accomplished absolutely nothing, they have been doing nothing but searching for an abductor for 7 years. They have come up with nobody. They haven't come up with even a shred, not a shred of evidence to support an abduction. Not one piece of evidence. I mean, it's a lot of work, and $20 million or whatever it's up to now, and a huge team of people working every day for 7 years to come up with absolutely nothing to support abduction. That right there is pretty damning.
It was a secret report written by Jim Gamble, the former head of CEOP, the Child Exploitation and Online Protection Centre, which helped trigger Operation Grange. The report reviewed the Portuguese police investigation. I put it to Jim Gamble that Operation Grange, now funded to the tune of more than $20 million, and with no visible signs of catching the suspect or suspects, it had to be considered a failure.
I don't think it has been a failure. You know, let's see, you know, what comes from it all. There will be evidence collected that at some time, at some stage in the future, may be able to help hold someone to account for this. Has it been a failure? Who's to say that now?
The CEOP report written by Gamble had stated it was best practice for police investigations in the cases of missing children to look at family and friends close to the victim first. I asked Jim Gamble why Operation Grange had not appeared to do that.
Operation Grange is different. Operation Grange is coming back after the fact. The best practice at the time the incident takes place is to capitalize on the golden hours. Operation Grange will have had the opportunity to reflect on all of the work that was done at the time the disappearance took place. All of the information that's been collected over the many years that have followed.
I pushed Jim Gamble again, trying to understand why Operation Grange appeared to be focused only on an abduction and why Scotland Yard investigators appeared to have not considered alternative theories.
I think they are well equipped to make the right judgments about where their starting point is. But I'm sure that they will have looked at every scrap of evidence, every report that was written. So if they've chosen to focus in a particular area, there will be a rationale for that, I have no doubt.
Finally, at the end of a conversation where I could sense Jim Gamble was tiring of my questions, I asked him, where was the evidence that an abduction took place?
You know, when the apartment was checked, Madeline was not there. So either she had left herself or she'd been abducted by someone else. She didn't simply disappear. So the evidence of absence leaves you with those two hypotheses. And, you know, as I said, I think time will tell. And I really hope it does. And I hope whoever was involved, whoever they are, if this is an abduction case, that they're identified and held to account. If it is a case that she went missing and inadvertently was hurt or worse and wasn't found, then I hope that comes to light as well.
When I spoke with Gonzalo Amaral, I asked what words came into his mind when I said Operation Grange.
That it's a cleanup, an image enhancement operation. Operation Grange is not following all of the investigation lines that are still open and that they should be following.
Gonzalo told me while he headed up the case that despite requests from Portugal to British police, his team was never sent the financial records of the McCanns. It is normal, Gonzalo said, in such cases to build a profile of the family and victim, and that profile includes financial matters. It's also normal to have access to the historical medical records of the victim. Gonzalo told me how the PJ had requested Madeline's medical records, but that no files were ever provided by British authorities. He was frustrated by that. He found it strange.
It was denied full, completely till the end. Not even a formal request letter was... Not even a formal request letter from the Portuguese authorities was able to produce those records. And he says that this is yet another mystery within the mystery. Gonzalo says that they received very little information. He has the feeling that they were never informed about everything.
During our conversation, I told Gonzalo about Dr. Mark Perlin and our efforts to get the DNA. I told him how Operation Grange had been aware of Dr. Perlin's pro bono offer to help them since March 2018. I told him how Scotland Yard and the UK government had repeatedly ignored my request for comment about Dr. Perlin's offer. I asked him what he made of that. Gonzalo mentions the FSS, which is of course the British lab whose DNA testing methods failed in 2007.
Gonzalo is not surprised at all because this is completely in line with what happened at the FSS back then. He says it would even be interesting to investigate the FSS work at the time and the notes that they took during their analysis. It does not surprise him that Scotland Yard has not taken the offer either, because Gonzalo believes that they are preparing the end of the case and that they are probably going to use a German pedophile who is in jail in England, and that he is probably going to be the scapegoat for the case. But he is expectant to see how they will do it, but he expects that this will be the solution of the case.
Wow, a German pedophile currently in prison in the UK.
Yes, he was allegedly in Portugal at the time, and he was investigated by the PJ at the time.
Okay.
When the case occurred and they discarded him.
Do we know his name?
Mas não está preso na Alemanha.
Mas ele está preso na Alemanha ou Inglaterra?
Está na Alemanha, é alemão, mas está preso pelo outros atos de pedofilia, não tem nada a ver com o caso.
Ah, ele está preso na Alemanha. Sorry, Mark, I misunderstood. He's in jail in Germany, and he was arrested over other, an unrelated situation.
Okay. It's possible to know his name or no?
Tu sabes como é que ele se chama?
Não, neste momento não.
Gonzalo explained how the German pedophile had been living in the Algarve. The PJ had investigated him at the time, but had found nothing to suggest he had snatched Madeline. Gonzalo claimed to me that Operation Grange had been working on another German pedophile, who he says, and I quote, "the British police wanted it to be," but that pedophile had died a few years ago. Gonzalo told me he did not believe the German pedophile jailed in a German prison had done it. He said, "I don't know how they will start it, but that will be the big ending. If... it ends." In the next episode of Maddie, Gonzalo Amaral and a criminal profiler examine some potential theories about events of May 3 in an attempt to answer the biggest question of all: what happened to Madeline McCann?
What happened here was that the investigation was interrupted, at the time that it was interrupted, the team was looking for an apartment that had been mentioned to them. The problem was that the investigation was interrupted and the police, the team, was not able to follow up this lead completely. It's not impossible, it has happened before, that bodies have been frozen.
The Maddie podcast is reported, written and narrated by me, Mark Salnokonoko. Dan McHugh is our producer and sound designer. Simon King is our editorial advisor and editor. You can read more about this case and the podcast and see interactive graphics and maps on 9.com.au.